This now is the 11th study period at the Arkansas Camp 1982 at 7:30 on Sunday evening. Let's come back to the fourth chapter now of Revelation. And we've been talking about the door in heaven, which we have concluded to be the door into the sanctuary. I should have read two statements to confirm this from Great Controversy, page 414. And from Patriarchs and Prophets, page 356. Let's just check those two statements right now. So we have the confirmation that this is indeed a revelation of the first department of the heavenly sanctuary. Page 414 in Great Controversy reads as follows. It comes from the chapter entitled, What is the Sanctuary? In which chapter, of course, a very strong point is made that the two apartments of the earthly sanctuary prefigure or shadow the corresponding two apartments of the heavenly. Page 414, Great Controversy. The matchless splendor of the earthly tabernacle reflected to human vision the glories of that heavenly temple where Christ our forerunner ministers for us before the throne of God, the abiding place of the King of Kings, where thousands minister unto him and 10,000 times 10,000 stand before him. Daniel 7 verse 10. That temple, filled with the glory of the eternal throne, where seraphim, its shining guardians, veiled their faces in adoration, could find in the most magnificent structure ever reared by human hands but a faint reflection of its vastness and glory. Yet important truths concerning the heavenly sanctuary and the great work there carried forward for man's redemption were taught by the earthly sanctuary and its services. The holy places of the sanctuary in heaven are represented by the two apartments in the sanctuary on earth. As in vision, the Apostle John was granted a view of the temple of God in heaven. He beheld there seven lamps of fire burning before the throne. And that statement, of course, comes from Revelation chapter 4 and verse 5. He saw an angel having a golden... Now, at this point now, remember Sister White is talking in this paragraph about the fact that there are two apartments in both the earthly and the heavenly, and the two earthly apartments represent two heavenly apartments, and she directs our attention to Revelation chapter 4 and verse 5 as a reference to the first apartment of the heavenly sanctuary. In other words, it says, as in vision, the Apostle John was granted a view of the temple of God in heaven. He beheld seven lamps of fire burning before the throne, Revelation 4, verse 5. At this point, now, it passes on to the second apartment by quoting Revelation 8 and verse 3 in these words. He saw an angel having a golden censer, and there was given unto him much incense, that he should offer it with the prayers of all saints upon the golden altar which is before the throne, Revelation 8, verse 3. It's my mistake, this is still the first apartment. Here the prophet was permitted to behold the first apartment of the sanctuary in heaven, and he saw there the seven lamps of fire and the golden altar represented by the golden candlestick and the altar of incense in the sanctuary on earth. Now, so far, references made to Revelation 4 and verse 5 and Revelation 8 verse 3, and in those verses the prophet was given a view of the first apartment of the sanctuary in heaven. It now passes on to the second apartment as follows. Again, the temple of God was opened, Revelation 11, verse 19, and he looked within the inner veil upon the Holy of Holies. Here he beheld the Ark of his Testament, represented by the sacred chest constructed by Moses to contain the law of God. Now, Patriarchs and Prophets, page 53, is virtually a repetition of the same words. Let's just check it quickly out at the moment. Page 356 in Patriarchs and Prophets. And I think we'll find it is virtually the same statement, so we won't take time to read the same words all over again. Yes, it's much the same statement, so we'll pass on from that point. Now, what we have been certifying so far in our consideration of the heavenly sanctuary is the fact that it does, in fact, have two apartments, just as the earthly sanctuary does. In the Book of the Writings, there's quite a chapter on it where Sister White describes the two apartments of the heavenly as they correspond to the same two apartments of the earthly. Or perhaps I should say this the other way around. I'll give you the reference, although I don't plan to through every part of the statement. The ceiling is rather long and concerns the furniture and the outlay of the sanctuary up in heaven above. Now, I stress this point this evening because so many people these days have come to the point where they have lost faith in the literal sanctuary of God up in heaven above. And it's very, very important that we who are to be God's instruments in the finishing of the work in these last days, we are to understand very clearly the correspondence between the earthly and the heavenly sanctuary, because very obviously, if we do not understand the work of Christ in the sanctuary above, we shall find ourselves ill-equipped to be God's instruments in the last great battle against the man of sin. Now, the reference is page 250 to page 253 in the book of your writings, and I'll leave you to read it for yourself sometime because it's quite lengthy. But this makes very, very clear that exactly as the earthly sanctuary had two apartments, so the heavenly likewise has two apartments up there above. A point which needs confirmation in these days of great apostasy. And just as, of course, there are two apartments, there are two different services. There's a daily service and, of course, the final or yearly service. So then, we turn back to Revelation 4 and verse 1. We have been looking at the expression, a door was opened in heaven. And then comes this mighty voice, which was, as it were, a trumpet, talking with me, which said, come up hither, and I will show thee thing which must be hereafter. I've often pondered what a voice that sounds like a trumpet must sound like, haven't you? It'd be very clear, it'd be very, very sharp in the sense of being crisp, although not harsh to listen to. At the same time, be very, very, it would carry a long way, it would get your attention, and would be very commanding as it sounded forth in your ears. And no doubt this trumpet, of course, was unlike any upon this earth. It was very much more beautiful and much more attractive than earthly trumpets are, even though it's a very fine instrument. I always enjoy good trumpet playing. Now the angel said, come up hither, and I will show thee thing which must be hereafter. We'll look at that word must be in more detail and depth a little later, but right now I want you to note it and keep it in your minds, because the angel said to John, I will show thee things which must be hereafter. Not what might be or possibly could be, but must be. Is that a positive expression? Very positive and very certain. And we'll see as we move on why the word must is applied to this particular verse. Now John was in the spirit immediately, and he saw a throne which was set in heaven, and one who sat upon this throne. Can we quickly identify who this being is who sits upon this throne? You say Christ? Anyone differ with that? Some say God the Father. Let's check it out and make certain. Let's pass across to chapter 5 and verse 1, where the same great being upon the throne is again mentioned. And I saw in the right hand of him that sat upon the throne a book written. So now this being upon the throne has a book. And now we come down to verse 6, and there we read about a lamb, as it had been slain, having seven horns and seven eyes. And very obviously, who is the lamb? Jesus Christ. And verse 7 says, and he, that is the lamb, came and took the book out of the right hand of him that sat upon the throne. Whoops. Did you make a mistake, Ralph? Apparently. Well, we all do sometimes, you know. No problem. So who then is this being upon the great white throne, upon the throne? Didn't say great white. It's God the Father. Very good. Now, here we find God the Father in the first apartment of the heavenly sanctuary. Does this create a problem? It certainly does. Why does it create a problem? Because in the Old Testament sanctuary, we invariably find the presence of God where? In the first apartment or the second apartment? Let's quickly draw the Old Testament sanctuary again. There's two apartments. In the second was the Ark of the Covenant. In the first was the altar of incense, the table of showbread, and the seven-branched golden candlesticks. standing in their places. We won't draw the courtyard because we're concerned tonight only with that part of the construction which represents the sanctuary of God up in heaven. Now, if I was to ask any of you who have read about the sanctuary, where would you find the presence of God in the Old Testament? Where would you say? Right, in the most holy place, between the cherubim, shining out from the position above the mercy seat. That's where we find the presence of God in the earthly sanctuary. Now, because of that, bearing in mind, of course, that the Old Testament sanctuary is a fairly accurate, in fact, a highly accurate representation of the heavenly sanctuary, because we find the presence of God almost always there in the most holy place, where alone do we expect to find the presence of God up in heaven? In the same place. But very distinctly and plainly we find in Revelation chapter 4 that God the Father is in which apartment? The first apartment. The holy place, or the first apartment of the heavenly sanctuary. Now let's look at a few scriptures to confirm the fact that God was indeed in the first apartment up until 1844. Now, when Jesus went to heaven, we're told again and again that he sat down on the right hand of the Majesty on high. Let's take, for instance, Hebrews, the first chapter, and begin with verse 1 and read down to verse 3. And these verses, of course, are specifically about Jesus Christ, the great high priest, the Savior of mankind. Here says, God, who at sundry times and in divers manners spake in time past unto the fathers by the prophets, hath in these last days spoken unto us by his Son, whom he hath appointed heir of all things, by whom also he made the worlds, who, being the brightness of his glory and the express image of his person, and upholding all things by the word of his power, when he had by himself purged our sins, sat down on the right hand of the Majesty on high. That's clear, isn't it? He sat down on God's right hand up in heaven above. There are other references like this in the book of Hebrews which tell us that Jesus Christ sat down on the right hand of his Father up in heaven. Now, when Christ went back to heaven, of course, he went back there, as we read earlier from Hebrews chapter 7 and 8, to be the minister of that true sanctuary which the Lord pitched and not man. Correct? Now we have a problem, because in the Old Testament dispensation, in the type, where do we find the high priest ministering up until the great day of atonement, which of course in the Antitype began in the year 1844. Let's put the date here, 1844. Now, from the death of Christ upon the cross up to 1844, according to the type, where must Christ have ministered? In the holy place. Now, let's put these two facts together now. The Old Testament sanctuary teaches, or appears to teach, that God was found only in the most holy place, both in the daily and the yearly service, right? Both in the daily and the yearly. The Old Testament sanctuary teaches that up until the great day of atonement, the high priest ministers in the holy place. So this then would tend to teach a separation between Jesus Christ and the Father up until 1844, would it not? You see my point? Right. But Hebrews tells us, in contradiction of this conclusion, that Christ sat down on the right hand of the Majesty on high. Now therefore, we have to come to one of two conclusions. That the Majesty on high left the most holy place and stayed with Christ in the first apartment till 1844, or Jesus Christ did not minister in the first apartment but went direct to his Father in the second apartment. We are left with to conclude one of those two things, aren't we? One of those two conclusions. Let's now determine which of those two conclusions is correct. And of course, naturally, we would lean toward the one which says that the Father join Christ in the holy place up until 1844, bearing in mind, of course, there were times when the presence of God filled the entire temple and was not confined to the holy place, the most holy place alone. We have to recognize, too, that there are certain limitations to the Old Testament sanctuary. As I read to you from page 414 in the book Great Controversy, the matchless splendor of the earthly tabernacle reflected to human vision the glories of that heavenly temple where Christ, our forerunner, ministers first before the throne of God. And a little further then it says that it was but a faint reflection of the vastness and glory of the heavenly sanctuary. So we must accept some limitations, obviously. Now, one limitation is the fact that an earthly high priest was not capable of continually ministering in the presence of God. So the frailty of humanity forced the presence of God to be kept within the most holy place throughout the daily services of the year, because the sons of the high priest were not able on a daily basis to minister in the presence of the King of Kings. But what about Jesus Christ in his Father's presence? Is that possible? There's no limitations there, are there? So we have to accept the fact that there are certain limitations imposed upon the earthly tabernacle because of its human ministration. We now turn to Ezekiel, the first chapter. We tend to think, of course, that God's throne is a fixture, because when you think of the thrones of earthly kings, what are they usually? Fixtures? Right, they're fixtures. They're placed in the throne room, and they're never moved. In olden times, of course, they sometimes had portable thrones on which the king sat and was carried from place to place. But generally speaking, the throne is placed right in the palace and it's never moved from that spot. But in Ezekiel, the first chapter, we're given a magnificent description of the throne of God, which is extremely interesting and informative. And it's made very plain and clear that God's throne is very mobile. It's extremely mobile. Let's start with verse 4. It's a long chapter. I don't think I'll read all of it, but we'll pick up some of the points as we go along. And I looked, and behold, a whirlwind came out of the north, a great cloud and a fire enfolding itself, and a brightness was about it, and out of the midst thereof is the color of amber out of the midst of the fire. Also, out of the midst thereof came the likeness of four living creatures, and this was their appearance. They had the likeness of a man, and every one had four faces, and every one of them had four wings. And their feet were straight feet, and the sole of their feet was like the sole of a calf's foot, and they sparkled like the color of burnished brass. And so it goes on down to verse 10, and here is a close resemblance to the description given of the four living creatures in Revelation chapter 4. As the likeness of their faces, they four had the face of a man, and the face of a lion on the right side, and they four had the face of an ox on the left side, and they four also had the face of an eagle. In Revelation chapter 4, the four living creatures were the same four images of a man, a lion, a calf in Revelation chapter 4, and an eagle. So very obviously, of course, there's a very close resemblance between each of these two. And we'll look into this in more detail too when time comes on. Now from verse 15 on, we have a picture of very complicated involutions of wheels within wheels, as far as these four creatures are concerned. Now passing on to verse 26. And above the firmament that was over their heads was the likeness of a throne, as the appearance of a sapphire stone, and upon the likeness of the throne was the likeness as the appearance of a man above upon it. And I saw as the color of amber, as the appearance of fire round about within it, from the appearance of his loins even upward, and from the appearance of his loins even downward, I saw as it were the appearance of fire, and it had brightness round about. As the appearance of the bow that is in the cloud in the day of rain, so was the appearance of the brightness round about. This was the appearance of the likeness of the glory of the Lord, and when I saw it, I fell upon my face, and I heard a voice of one that spake. So let's now notice the sequence here in verse 26. He sees a firmament or an expanse, and above that there was a throne as the appearance of a sapphire stone, and on that throne he saw a very wonderful being. As it says in verse 28, this was the appearance of the likeness of the glory of the Lord. Passing back a little bit now, let me find the exact verse again. We talked about the throne moving with the speed of lightning from one end of the heaven to the other. verse 14. Let's take verses 13 and 14. As for the likeness of the living creatures, their appearance was like burning coals of fire, and like the appearance of lamps, it went up and down among the living creatures, and the fire was bright, and out of the fire went forth lightning. And the living creatures ran and returned as the appearance of a flash of lightning. They ran and returned as the appearance of a flash of lightning. Does that give the idea of great mobility? Certainly does, doesn't it? So God's throne then is a living throne, which is not anchored to any given spot, but has the capacity to move to and fro throughout the sanctuary or the universe at will. It's worth noticing, of course, that the throne is like a sapphire stone. What color is sapphire? Blue, that's correct. In Revelation chapter 20, when the last great confrontation takes place between God and the resurrected wicked, and Christ then sits upon a great throne, what color is that throne? Yes, right, it's white. That's quite correct. It's a great white throne. So apparently God has two thrones. One is the great white throne, which is the judgment throne, and the blue throne must be the throne of mercy or the throne of grace. It's also, of course, the throne of His glory. We've now established the fact that God's throne is a living throne with the capacity to move backwards and forwards across heaven with the speed of lightning, which, of course, is extremely fast. We now turn to Daniel, the 7th chapter, in which we have a description of the change over from the first to the second apartment of the heavenly sanctuary. And this picture, of course, is a very, very clear and plain one. It leaves no doubt at all as to the fact that there was a transition which took place in 1844. Now, I assume, I hope quite correctly, that practically everybody in this room is quite familiar with Daniel 7, in which we have brought to view four great beasts, the lion, the bear, the four-headed leopard with four wings, and of course the great dragon with 10 horns and great iron teeth. Furthermore, we know that these four great beasts symbolize four great world empires, as is confirmed by looking at verse 17. These great beasts, which are four kings, which shall arise out of the earth. Now, the fourth of those great powers was the pagan Roman system, symbolized by the great dragon beast with the 10 horns. A little horn power which arose out of the, or amongst those 10, after displacing three of them, of course, is the papacy. And then after the rise of the papacy and her reign of power, we find in verse 9, Daniel 7 verse 9, these words, "I beheld till the thrones were cast down, and the Ancient of Days did sit, whose garment was white as snow, and the hair of his head like the pure wool, his throne was like the fiery flame, and his wheels as burning fire." Now the words "cast down" can be rather misleading, because those words are used in the setting of an ancient Eastern courtroom, not in a modern setting. In actual fact, the verse should read, and does read in modern translations, "I beheld till thrones were placed," or "set up," or in other words, "I beheld that the judgment room had been made ready for the judgment scene." Now the custom back in the days of when the Bible was actually written, or Daniel was actually written, was for the dignitaries in the court to sit cross-legged on huge cushions. When the time came to set up the judgment room, servants came in and they cast down these great cushions around the room, and when the judgment room was prepared, all the dignitaries came in and took their places cross-legged on these cushions. You tend to get the idea from this verse at first reading, of course, that there were great battles and earthly thrones were overturned, kingdoms took the place of kingdoms and so forth, but that is not the idea at all. So now, form in your minds that picture of the judgment room being prepared for the judgment scene. And then it says, "And the Ancient of Days did sit, whose garment was white as snow, and the hair of his head like the pure wool, his throne was like the fiery flame, and his wheels as burning fire." In other words, if the thrones were placed and then the Ancient of Days had sits, what does this plainly show so far as his presence in that room was concerned prior to the casting down of these thrones? He wasn't there, was he? it gives to us a picture of a grand entry of the King of Kings and Lord of Lords. Let's read now verse 10. A fiery stream issued and came forth from before him. Thousands ministered unto him, and 10,000 times 10,000 stood before him. The judgment was set, and the books were opened. And we know, of course, from Daniel chapter 8, verse 14, and Revelation chapter 14, 6 to 12, that the time for the opening of those books was in 1844. Sister White was given a specific vision of this transition from the first to the second apartment of the heavenly sanctuary, and I'll read this in the book of the writings, page 54. In this vision, page 54 of the writings, Sister White says, I saw a throne, not two of them, but just one throne, and on it sat the Father and the Son. And that ties in, of course, with Revelation chapter 3, the Laodicean church, where the promise is made to him that overcometh, will I grant to sit with me in my throne, even as I also overcame and have set them with my Father in his throne. So Christ then shares the Father's throne. They sat side by side on that throne. Now I'm going to, in the sanctuary picture here, draw the presence of God and of Christ. We'll just move the altar of incense for the moment. And we'll draw a throne here in plain view, of course. And Jesus Christ sits on the Father's right hand. So the Father sits there on the left of Christ, and Christ on the right of his Father. And let's put the altar of incense back before the throne, because the incense ascends up before the throne of God. Now, at the moment, while I have drawn this in the first apartment, what I've read so far does not confirm that. But as we pass on to the next page, what I'm passing over is a paragraph describing the glory of Jesus Christ as a true reflection of his Father's glory. It now comes back to describe the movement of the Father as follows. I saw the Father rise from the throne and in a flaming chariot go into the Holy of Holies within the veil and sit down. And note those exact words. The statement says that the Father rose from the throne and in a flaming chariot, which reminds us of Daniel chapter 7, doesn't it? The chariot of fire. And he went into the Holy of Holies within the veil, and he took his seat upon the throne in there. So there's a clear picture there of the transition of God in 1844 from the first to the second apartment of the heavenly sanctuary. We now find that Jesus Christ follows him in a very short while. Then Jesus rose up from the throne, and the most of those who bowed down arose with him. I did not see one ray of light pass from Jesus to the careless multitude after he arose, and they were left in perfect darkness. Those who arose when Jesus did kept their eyes fixed upon him as he left the throne and led them out a little way. So first of all, Christ left the throne here in the holy place, stepped out a little way while his people down upon this earth, by living faith and the ministration of God's Spirit, followed him by faith in his movements up in the sanctuary above. Then he raised his right arm, and we heard his lovely voice saying, wait here, I am going to my Father to receive the kingdom. Keep your garments spotless, and in a little while I'll return from the wedding and receive you unto myself. Now this statement, and all this vision given to Sister White, makes it very, very clear that the Father and the Son were together in the holy place of the heavenly sanctuary up until 1844. Then what did they both do in turn? Transferred from the first to the second apartments. Let's read just a little further down in early writings, page 55. Then a cloudy chariot with wheels like flaming fire, surrounded by angels, came to where Jesus was. He stepped into the chariot and was borne to the holiest where the Father sat. There I beheld Jesus, a great high priest, standing before the Father. On the hem of his garments was a bell and a pomegranate, the bell and the pomegranate. Those who rose up with Jesus would send up their faith to him in the holiest and pray, my Father, give us thy spirits. Then Jesus would breathe upon them the Holy Ghost. In that breath was light, power, and much love, joy, and peace. As we know, of course, the transition from the first to the second apartment was a very momentous event in the history of God's church and God's people. And what we've done so far is to establish that in verse 3, the Father was in fact seated in the first apartment of the heavenly sanctuary. And we conclude that the reason why the Old Testament sanctuary does not show this particular geographical position of God during the daily service was because the earthly ministry could not were not qualified or fitted to stand directly in God's presence on a daily basis. Whereas, of course, Christ has no problem in that particular respect. We now have the picture before our minds a little more clearly then, that, as verse 3 points out, and he that sat was to look upon like a jasper and a sardine stone, and there was a rainbow round about the throne in sight like unto an emerald. Now the presence of that rainbow around the throne of God is the covenant, it's God's signature through a covenant which he made with Noah and his family back after the flood, that never again would this earth perish by a flood. And there's very, very beautiful symbolism in the rainbow of promise, which we'll develop shortly. But let's go on a little further now to look at the organization of the heavenly throne room in the first apartment of the sanctuary back when John was given this view of that room. Let's look now at verse 4. And around about the throne were 24 seats, and upon the seats I saw 24 elders sitting, clothed in white raiment, and they had on their heads crowns of gold. Now a little further down, verse 6, and before the throne there was a sea of glass like unto crystal, and in the midst of the throne and around about the throne were four beasts, or four living creatures, as we agreed to call them, full of eyes before and behind. Now let's establish, first of all, who these beings were. 24 elders and four living creatures. It's not difficult, of course. We turn across to Revelation, the 5th chapter, and read together verses 8 to 10, wherein we're plainly told in clear terms who these individuals were. Verse 8 of Revelation chapter 5. And when he had taken the book, the four beasts and 24 elders fell down before the Lamb, having every one of them harps and golden vials full of odors, which are the prayers of saints. And they sang a new song, saying, Thou art worthy to take the book and to open the seals thereof. Let's stop there for a moment. In the first part of verse 1, it says, And they sang a new song. Who are they? The 24 elders and the four living creatures. Right? Is that clear? It's the two parties referred to back in verse 8, which says, And when he had taken the book, the four living creatures and the 24 elders fell down. Now verse 9, And they sung a new song. So does this not include then both the 24 elders and the four living creatures? Very good. Now what do they say? They say, Thou, that is the Lamb, art worthy to take the book and to open the seals thereof, for thou wast slain and hast redeemed us to God by thy blood out of every kindred and tongue and people and nation, and hast made us unto our God kings and priests, and we shall reign upon the earth. The word redeemed means to buy back. And throughout the entire universe, there's only one class of individuals or created beings who have ever been bought back by the blood of Jesus Christ. And who are they? Right? People from this earth. So therefore, the 24 elders and the four living creatures represent a company, or companies, if you like to say, of people who have been redeemed from this earth and who have been taken up to minister with Jesus Christ in the holy place of the heavenly sanctuary. Now bear in mind, of course, that this is while Christ was in the holy place. That was prior to 1844, and in fact, of course, was the same point of time as that in which John himself lived. He was being given a view of the holy place of the heavenly sanctuary as it was before the seven seals were opened and the four horsemen of the apocalypse began to ride forth through history. So really, of course, it wasn't John's time, really before his time, that is before the time when he actually saw these things. It went back to that point where he was virtually at the cross of Calvary, before the events of the New Testament era began to unfold. That was the viewpoint that John had at that point of time. Now, at that point of time then, what human beings
were in the sanctuary that they could qualify to occupy the position of being the four living creatures and the 24 and 20 elders. Who were they? Exactly. Those who were resurrected when Christ was raised up and went back to heaven with him to, as the first, as the harvest, which followed his being raised from the dead as the first fruits. There's a very fine statement in the book Desire of Ages covering this particular point. Let's turn to it now to read on page 786 and 786 of the book Desire of Ages. It says, as Christ arose, he brought from the grave a multitude of captives. I wonder how many there were altogether. There must have been quite a company of them. The earthquake at his death had rent open their graves, and when he arose, they came forth with him. Now, who were they? They were those who had been co-laborers with God, and who, at the cost of their lives, had borne testimony to the truth. Now they were to be witnesses for him who had raised them from the dead. Christ was the first fruits, and they were the harvest, which were gathered as a result of the first fruits being successfully offered. Now they were those who, at the cost of their lives, had borne testimony to the truth. In other words, the martyrs of the Old Testament, Peter and John the Baptist, were raised at that point of time, and they went back to heaven with Jesus Christ when he went up to heaven. Obviously then, of course, Abel will be one person in that company. John the Baptist will be another. I understand that when the golden calf was raised, there were some people who refused to bow, and they lost their lives for the truth, and we assume that they'll be there in heaven as well. And I understand Isaiah was died of martyr's death, so he'll be there. And many, many others who are unknown to us at the present time are presently with Jesus Christ in the first apartment, ministering together with him. They, the sons of the high priest, and he, of course, the high priest himself. In addition to those who were raised when Christ was raised, there are three more, namely, of course, Enoch, Moses, and Elijah, who most certainly would take their place amongst the 24 elders up in the heavenly throne room. Let's come back now to the early part of chapter 4. They've now identified the four living creatures and the 24 elders. Not that we know them all by name. We do know some by name, but not every one of them, of course. Now, the statement says in verse 4 that these 24 elders are clothed in white raiment. Is that a symbolic statement, or is it just simply literal? Well, it's both. Very good, it's both. Now, what kind of raiment, very obviously, of course, will they be wearing? Linen, or cotton, or wool, or light? Light. They'll have the same beautiful garment of light as Adam and Eve had back in the Garden of Eden. That garment of light, which was a symbol of the righteousness which they enjoyed at that point of time. There's a statement in the book Christ Object Lesson which caught my attention just a few weeks ago. I won't have time to pursue this too far at the moment. I hope I remember to start next study with this same statement. Maybe you should remind me. But in the chapter entitled The Wedding Garments, beginning on page 307 of the book Christ Object Lessons, we find on the bottom of page 310 in the book Christ Object Lessons these words: the white robe of innocence was worn by our first parents when they were placed by God in Holy Eden. They lived in perfect conformity to the will of God. All the strength of their affections was given to their Heavenly Father. A beautiful soft light, the light of God, enshrouded the holy pair. This robe of light was a symbol of their spiritual garments of heavenly innocence. Had they remained true to God, it would ever have continued to enshroud them. And when sin entered, they severed their connection with God, and the light that had encircled them departed. Naked and ashamed, they tried to supply the place of the heavenly garments by sewing together fig leaves for a covering. Now, if today, when we became Christ's children, received his righteousness, we got back that robe of light, it would forever end the question as to who were Christians and who were not, wouldn't it? No more question as to who is a wise and foolish virgin. But fortunately, God has not given to us an outward visible token of our righteousness. He can't, of course, because of the fact that we still live in fallen, sinful, mortal humanity. And that fallen, sinful, mortal humanity is not able to wear a robe of beautiful light as Adam and Eve had back in the Garden of Eden. Now, while they were righteous, the robe remained. The moment they lost their righteousness, they also lost that robe. And so they had a visible evidence before their very eyes of their great loss at that point of time. When they regained the righteousness of Jesus Christ, but not more immortality, they did not as yet regain that garment of light. But when we go to heaven, it will again be our lot to wear a garment of light which will never need to be mended or replaced. It will be something which will be as eternal as the eternal life which we have in ourselves at that point of time. And naturally, of course, when Enoch, Moses, Elijah, and the multitude of captives went back with Jesus Christ, they all received again that gleaming, glorious garment of white light which reveals the presence of the eternal righteousness of God within them. Now, time has gone once more, so we'll stop at this point.